Hey everyone, welcome to another long-awaited episode of Sermon Postscript, where we kind of dissect and discuss the sermon at hand. My name is Eugene. I'm a member on staff here. I'm also with Jay, who just preached the sermon with us.
So guys.
So as Jay, if you were here on Zoom, Jay started a new sermon series through the book of Judges, and we looked through Judges chapter 2. But I guess the first question I want to ask you, Jay, was you talked about a little bit during the service, but yeah, just I guess your hopes and thoughts of like starting a sermon series through Judges. You talked about it. I think most of our church only knows Judges with the story of Samson, but it's a pretty crazy book. But yeah, I guess just your own thoughts of why you started this book.
Yeah, you know, whenever I look at Old Testament passages or even just narrative passages in the Bible, one of the things that I try to look at it through the lens is through the lens of someone who grew up in church. And I think a lot of times people who grew up in church, we know a lot of the biblical stories and are familiar with the stories, but don't necessarily see how it connects to our modern culture. So I wanted to take a look at the book of Judges, one that is only familiar if you know Samson, and trying to see how an ancient text like the book of Judges, how that's still very applicable to our day and age. And so yeah, just kind of like what I mentioned, we wanted to take a look at this book and see how just the ups and downs of a basically a nation that is, you know, in its first generation of growth, and how easy it is for a people who had just the previous generation witnessed miracles done by God so easily fall away from trusting and relying upon Yahweh. And I think there's a lot of parallels that we can take from that as a American, as Christians living in this evangelical world, and how easy it is for us to be able to forget our trust and reliance upon Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith.
Yeah, no, that's, I'm excited. I mean, the one verse that's always repeated in Judges is everyone did right what was right in their own eyes, which I think captures everything of our age really well. So I'm really excited to get into it. But yeah, as we just went through Judges 2, kind of, and yeah, I think Judges 2 sets up the table really well. And I think within your message, there's a couple questions that I had that I think the church might have too, alongside your points. I think the first point you made was how, you know, for Israel at that time, in the beginning of Judges, they got so full of their own success and they thought it was God's blessing when it surely isn't. That's the whole book's case, that it's not. And one question I had was this, like, I think living in the Silicon Valley, you know, when me or you used to go to Google or Facebook to eat, I really enjoyed those times. And a lot of that is due to the success of those people or those companies. And I think one question that popped in my mind is, well, how can we stay successful, strive for success, but not confuse that with God's blessing? Because I do think people here understand that concept in theory, at least. But I think the main question they might have is, look, in my job, I have to be successful or I'm kind of going to be fired. So as a Christian, how would you best practically advise to balance those two?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I think the way that I would like to distinguish it is there is success in the eyes of the world, which as long as it aligns with God's calling for us as Christians, is something that we should strive after. But then there's also success in the eyes of God, which I think can be countercultural. It can often be something that the world doesn't recognize as success. And I think as Christians, if we are able to set the success in godly terms as our main priority and allow the successes that we achieve or even strive after in our worldly sense, as long as those are aligned together, then I think it makes it a little easier for us to strive after. But what happens oftentimes, you know, not just in my own life, but in the culture here and people, we only look at worldly success and we think that that is a sign of God's blessing on us. You know, so I guess a practical example that I could give when I first moved up to the Bay Area to start a church, I made sure that my heart was always aligned with what I felt was God's view of success. That my taking the step of faith to move my family up to the Bay Area and to stay obedient to God, that itself was a sign of success, not the worldly term, which is like, oh, how big is your church going to get? You know, like, what's the impact that you're going to make, you know, and just what is the critical, you know, how big is the critical mass that you're going to have, and how many followers do you have, you know? And so I think when we are able to define and identify what is godly success and what is the success that God is after, and we can align it with our goals, then that is, that makes it a little bit easier for us to follow.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's really good. I think that's a category that even for myself, we don't actually take time to think about. I mean, we take so much time to map out our worldly success, you know, whether it be career goals or 5-year plans, which is all needed. But I think that's good advice, because rarely do we ask, maybe, okay, given all that, what does success in a godly fashion look like in your workplace? Which I think is a good piece of advice.
Yeah, you know, and there's a, you know, a former member at our church. This, I think this is a great story and analogy to this. But you know, some of you may or may not know him, but he was, in the eyes of the Silicon Valley, a very successful, you know, engineer, individual, and programmer. You know, he mm-hmm. had a good job at one of the top companies. He, you know, had a lot of stocks invested in that company. But in his own heart, he felt called by God to pursue a new career, you know, and to leave and go back to the East Coast. And even before his stocks were vetted, and for, like, in a worldly sense, we could have been like, whoa, hey, just wait a few more months until your stocks are vested and then make this change.
Yeah.
But for him, he felt that the calling was more urgent and the change was needed. And it was something that it wasn't just him, you know, like chasing after worldly success. He was really seeking, like, how can I be more obedient to God's calling for my life? And yeah. he was willing and able to give up hundreds of thousands of dollars in stocks and, yeah. you know, a comfortable job and the prestige to go follow after what he felt God is calling him to. And I think it's that type of mindset that we as Christians need to live counterculturally, to seek after that type of obedience and success in God's eyes, as opposed to success in the world's eyes.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think that's really good. So moving on with the second point, you kind of also tie into how, okay, Israel got full of their worldly success and confused it with godly success, and how that kind of translates into, oftentimes it could be you get there because you're religious with God, but you're not in a relationship with God. And, you know, I really, at least that point struck well with me, because, and you talked about it, especially as pastors, that's so true. But I think even for our congregation and lay members too. And I guess for us, what one practical question I wanted to ask is, well, how do you, you know, I think that's a blanket statement, which is needed, and I think everyone feels that. But I think on a practical sense, like, what are the practical realities that you see that worry you, that might worry you, like, oh, I think if you do this or that, that is being more religious than actually being gospel-centered or having a relationship with Christ?
You know, yeah, I think this is definitely, you know, every case is different. Mm-hmm. But I think generally speaking, and always changes depending on your life stage, but there's always moments in your life where there is that one particular idol that you are seeking after, you know? Mm. So like in high school, that idol might be like popularity, or it might be grades so that you can get into a top 5 university of your choice, you know? And then in college, it might be a relationship. Or it might be a particular degree or a major. And then, you know, as you grow older, it might be your career, it might be a spouse, it might be your children. Mm-hmm. And I think oftentimes the very thing that you are truly idolizing in your stage of life, if you aren't able to get it or attain it, and then you turn to religious rituals, hoping that the favor of God will give that to you, I think that is a sign that you are more about religion than a relationship.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, so like, I'm sure there are people here who are wanting a new job and they're studying for interviews and they want to move on, whether it's starting their own company or getting a new job at another place. And when things don't seem like it's going well, then they immerse themselves in quote unquote, the holy activities of, hey, I need to pray more, read the Bible more, or join some Bible studies and hoping, whether it's blatantly or subconsciously, that by doing this, that God will somehow turn his favor upon them. Mm. And I think if your heart's inclined toward that type of thinking and behavior, then most likely you are more founded in religion than an actual relationship with God, the Savior, you know? And this isn't to call out anyone specifically. I think we, as human beings, we all struggle with this type of legalistic tendency.
Totally.
You know? And it's just at this, you know, and I think that's where deep introspection and prayer and accountability and community is helpful for us to be able to point those things out.
Yeah. And to you, you touched on this too. And this just fresh my mind because I just preached a sermon on doubt and had a small podcast about this too. But I think to do that, you really got to deconstruct. That's a loaded term, but you have to deconstruct your faith. Because I think that happens so, like, in the shadows of your soul, if that makes sense. Like, because for you to talk about that, you can't audit that unless you, like, really sit down and deconstruct, okay, where am I spiritually? Because it's right. Like, even for me or you, sometimes we can't tell. Because you can go through the motions, and we're like, yeah, everything's fine. So I think that's really key, that to do what Jay's talking about, man, you got to really, like, find an intentional space to really, okay, deconstruct where am I at with Christ. And that's something that I've been trying to do every day. And it's scary to kind of live with the consequences, but I think that's the only way you can kind of move forward from that.
Yeah, definitely. You're absolutely right. And you know, and for those people that have not listened to the podcast yet, I think it's, you know, what you and, you know, Tom and Jason were talking about in your podcast was, it's a wonderful tool to be able to be a catalyst for that type of, I think, healthy deconstruction.
Yeah.
You know, and I think you guys mentioned in the podcast, deconstruction without the hope and goal of reconstruction is a dead end, right?
Yeah.
And deconstruction isn't a new phenomenon. It's happened all the time, especially like when people graduate from high school and they go to college, and now their parents are no longer forcing them to go to church.
Yeah,
and, you know, and it often happens a lot of times in colleges, right? Where young people start wondering, like, is this faith actually real? And I think this pandemic of, like, you know, the last 15 months of people not having to go to church or unable to go to church, it really gave some people the opportunity to, like, ask, like, is this faith my own? You know, and totally. Is it real? And I think that's a positive thing when that type of doubt and deconstruction points us to a firmer foundation in who Christ is in our lives.
Yeah, which ties perfectly into your last point, that we have a God that is patient amid all of this that we're doing, right? And judges, well, not just judges, but the whole point of the Old Testament is ultimately, I think, that story, that God is patient with a people that is completely rebellious and idolatrous and isn't true in their faith with him. So I guess with that, the last question I wanted to ask you is, you know, how, and this might be a cheesy answer for some of us, but I think it's needed. Like, with everything that we talked about, I think the only way to really be close with God amidst your failures in the first two points is to remind yourself of the patience of God. And this might be corny, but how do you do that, right? We talked about this here and there, probably in sermons or podcasts or whatever. But for you, I guess, personally, as a lead pastor at True North, like, what are ways that you're reminded of God's patience amidst our own rebelliousness?
You know, I think the biggest thing is humility, and I think a sign of true Christian humility comes when we slowly and gradually understand that there is nothing in us that deserves salvation. Mm-hmm. You know, like, we are literally, if you take the worst characters in the Bible, and even the heroes of the Bible, there really isn't that much difference between the two. You know, like, mm-hmm. like, for example, you take Peter and then you take Judas. Where's the difference? Not much.
Yeah.
Right? The main difference between Peter and Judas is the grace by which God bestows upon Peter as opposed to Judas. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's when we are able to humbly announce and confess our complete and total depravity, and that the only reason why we are saved is because of the kindness and patience of God, not because we had, like, a little bit, you know, 1% better than the non-believer or whatever the case is.
Yeah.
And I truly think it's that level of humility that allows us to then really marvel at how patient and kind and gracious God is with us. And I think it's that recognition of the goodness of God that can really help us and turn us to really seek a relationship with Him, and not just seek to do religious activities.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think that's really good. If I had to add anything, I think the ultimate act of humility is confession. That when you confess your sins, it's not a guilt trip, but I think it's more of a reminder God is still faithful in your confession. And I think that's something that we all struggle with, especially here at True North. So I think that's a good, maybe practical reminder of humility for ourselves.
Yeah, I catch myself all the time, you know, just like reading the news of pastors who are falling from grace, you know, or churches who are, you know, like being bombarded with scandal, and it's so easy for me just to be like, man, I knew it. Those guys are whack.
those fools, you know, and
feel all like high and mighty about like, oh, because I'm not involved in any sort of scandal.
Yeah.
But again, when I take a deep look at my own self and my own sin, it's really by the grace of God that I have been away from any type of scandal or you know, mainstream news, and I think it's just that reminder that helps us to remember it's really by God's grace and His goodness and not of our own doing.
Yeah, well, I hope you're blessed or helped with this postscript as we kind of just deconstructed the sermon at hand. But it's just a reminder too, we're meeting outdoors this upcoming Sunday, so if you'd like to come out, just sign up through our website. We'd love to see you there, and we hope you're blessed through this series of Judges as we start. So thanks for listening.
All right, thanks, guys. See you guys next week.